Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today, our guest is Carl Elefante. Carl is a former president of the American Institute of Architects and has led the field in finding common ground between two things seemingly in conflict, sustainable design and historic preservation. He is a principal emeritus with Quinn Evans and a charter member of the Climate Heritage Network. In addition to his work on the intersection of historic preservation and sustainability, he has spent decades focusing on building sector decarbonization, community vitality, and urbanism, and he is here to talk about his new book, Going for Zero, Decarbonizing the Built Environment on the Path for Our Urban Future. Welcome, Carl.
Well, great to be here, Daniel and Craig. Thanks so much for having me here.
I think it's fairly common parlance now that people think that reducing carbon, operating carbon, embodied carbon, is an important objective of design and operation of our built environment. So what is the new message that is contained in Going for Zero, and what did you sort of set out to disambiguate? What do you think we're still getting wrong about this equation?
So the reason why I felt like this book would be useful is really kind of twofold. The first is that we're very much in a demanding world, you know, that what it takes to design and renovate and, you know, construct and operate buildings, it's a real heads down world. It's so involving. It's very hard to get a minute in your life that isn't absorbed by what you're thinking about on your projects. You know, so I had the opportunity through what I did at Quinn Evans, and then also what I did with things like being involved with AIA and ultimately becoming AIA president, to sort of get out of the office a little bit and to understand the larger context into which our work fits. So that's the first thing, that I think actually really understanding that there's a big kind of a new importance to our work that intersects with a lot of very, very big picture changes that the 21st century is about. And then the second is that because I got to practice in a kind of an unusual way, in an unusual place, as you said in your introduction, kind of bringing together historic preservation and sustainable design, which I have to tell you, 30 years ago when I started that a lot of people just thought I was completely out of my mind, and that there wasn't any intersection there, and the historic preservation people didn't consider sustainability a goal, and the green world that I was part of wondered why I was talking about existing buildings and historic preservation. So actually, that perspective that I got really gave me a kind of an alternative perspective on the value of what we do. So really, those are the two things that I really felt like I could share by writing a book like this.
And something I forgot to mention at the top, you are the person who is credited with saying that the most sustainable building is the one that's already built. What was the context for that comment, and when did you make it? I'm just kind of curious, going back a little bit in time.
Yeah, so I tell this story in the book, but you know, I had at this point probably spent 10 years at trying to bring together the stewardship of sustainability and the stewardship of historic preservation, you know, cultural preservation. And I was at a conference in Chicago, which was devoted to historic tax credits. So it was lawyers and accountants talking about all this sort of fine-grained things about, you know, about the historic tax credit program. And my presentation was after lunch on the last day. Everybody was already half asleep, you know, and I thought I had been cursed with this speaking spot that I was in. So I just decided that I had to sort of wake the room up a little bit. And I did a call and response, and I put two new slides into my presentation. The first slide said, the greenest building is ... And the second slide was ... one that is already built. And I did this, like, you know, call and response. And after like four or five times, I had a room full of lawyers and accountants actually kind of believing what they were saying with the greenest building as one that's already built. And I thought, you know what, that's an important message. We have to get that out. And I ended up writing a journal article for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, you know, with that title. And I'll tell you, that paper, to this day, I get notifications three or four times a week about that paper being quoted somewhere around the world. So the ripple effects are still going 20 years later.
Well, before diving deeper into the book, Carl, this is where I feel obligated to ask, since you had a room of accountants and lawyers, you know, chanting along with you, and as a former president of the AIA, I'm curious what you think of, like, Frank Duffy made this critique 15 plus years ago in Work in the City. You know, he asked our architects, slaves at the mill, mindlessly churning out the built environment because that's what they're incentivized to do. This is something that I've always been fascinated about, you know, how do you change the field towards preservation, towards other outcomes rather than the raw production of space? And I'm curious how that plays into, how the profession itself and the field itself plays into the challenges and the solutions you lay out.
Yeah, so it's a very important question. And, there's that expression, for a person with a hammer, all problems look like nails. And you know, we have that problem. I mean, I went to architecture school because I wanted to design and build cool stuff. I didn't have a social mission. I didn't know what was going on in the world. I didn't know what the implications were going to be of the cool stuff that I designed and built. Just what I wanted to do. So we do have that dilemma, and it's one of the reasons why I think I felt it was very important to define the 21st century imperatives in my book and to sort of start there, to simply reconnect with the outcomes of what we do. And, you know, one of the things that's incredibly powerful about our profession is that we are futurists and we are trying to create a better future. And architects and engineers and contractors the people that shape human habitation for a living, we get up every morning thinking we're going to make the world a better place by what we do. And we go to bed at night convinced that we have. And look around our world. How many people are devoting themselves to making the future better? You know, so we have an incredibly important voice, an incredibly important perspective on the importance of what we do, and connecting it to really what the outcomes are. And it is an important adjustment that we need to make. And right now, the reality of those outcomes is there's almost nothing in the westernized version of what we do to design and build buildings that doesn't have this problem of contributing to global warming. And it's also connected to other problems too, which we'll talk about today. But you know, clearly climate change is sort of the driver of the retooling that we're doing. And so how do we connect that retooling to actually understanding not just the implications of what we do for climate change, but what it means in terms of social issues and economic issues, and literally the kind of the resources in the world, et cetera. So, we have a major kind of realignment that's really required of what we're doing, what our priorities are, et cetera.
One of the realignments that you describe in the book has to do with, and I think you've alluded to this already in the conversation where you sort of talked about the Western world. You know, we used to call it the first, second, and third world. Now it's kind of a global north, global south conversation. But you do talk about the global north bias that we go into with projects, regardless of where they're being constructed. Can you think of an example where a project team went into the work with a preconceived global north basis or bias, and they were able to adapt more time-honored techniques or more locally appropriate or more sustainable techniques to achieve a more lasting or meaningful result?
Yeah, so I wish I could tell you a lot more, than exists, but I would say that this has begun, and there are people that are really kind of walking that path. Probably the one here in the U.S. that's best known is Mass Design, and their work in Africa, where they're really trying to understand the context there. They're trying to understand the indigenous architectural traditions, the indigenous material traditions, etc., and really understanding how they could incorporate that into the new building projects that they're doing. So that's a good example of literally a global north firm walking into that situation and saying, we're not here to export all of our great ideas. We're really here to try to understand the intersection of what we know and the intersection of what so, and then the other example I'd point to is kind of the opposite. Somebody is sort of from that world, from the global south, but understands what the sort of progress of the global north has been, and so on, and really, again, is trying to understand that intersection of what he grew up with versus what he went to college and learned, if you will. And that's Francis Carey, so he's just an amazing architect. Is just incredibly beautiful work, a Pritzker Prize winner. I mean, doesn't get any better. And yet, the work that he's done back home in Africa, and particularly in Burkina Faso, but elsewhere in Africa, where he realizes my work has to be sort of the people, by the people, and for the people. And how do we build? We build out of, clay brick that we make ourselves. And we are the work crew. At any rate, so his work in Africa is just really, really interesting, that to kind of demonstrate this idea that, we are in the 21st century. We're not just going to build in indigenous buildings. We have need to build larger buildings, build buildings faster, build buildings that have mechanical systems that are incorporated, or electricity. That's, I mean, it's the 21st century world, and yet how to be really sensitive to the traditions that are there, and realize that there's real value in them. Building out of adobe is not anachronistic. It's a great material. I can point to cities that are 1,000-year-old adobe cities that are still there. I mean, those buildings are still there. People still live in them. They're still viable buildings. Can you point to me an insulated glass building that's 1,000 years old that people are still living in? Our technology is very new, and from my perspective, a historic preservation architect, our technology is completely unproven. It's only existed 100 years. It can't even stand up to the test of what's its value 1,000 years from now.
I'm so glad you mentioned Mass Design. I love their concept of LoFab, some of their work they've done in Rwanda there, about thinking about localized fabrication. And of course, reminded me of Low Tech. I have Julia Watson's book here on the shelf right behind. And I guess the point is, like, there's so many great tools in this kit along these lines, Carl. I'm curious your thoughts about what other tools do we need? But then also, how do we change the giant supply chains and procurement chains that underlie the production of those glass and steel buildings, and really sort of scale this up? Because I feel like this is what the conversation that Dan and I had in Venice this year at the Architecture Biennale, of like, it felt like a lot of the exhibition was like, here's all these potential solutions. And it feels like we should be 15 years of where that conversation is, in the sense of, here's how we reoriented supply chains to build them. And I'm sort of curious, what do you think are the major bottlenecks, or how do we start producing this at scale beyond compendiums of great techniques?
So I think it's a big change, and it's difficult, and it's going to take a lot of effort, and it's going to take a lot of time. But that said, I think there are forces that are sort of aligned to really encourage us to do that, and to find value in doing that. So again, I'm going to kind of restate my historic preservation background, and what I found with renewing existing buildings was that, what did it actually take? Well, it took a lot of high-skilled people to be able to come in, and actually very little material, very little energy expenditure. And it was a kind of care and feeding of something that was already there. And it was a whole different mindset about what was needed to make that work successful. And, you know, began to understand that we could go to a city council and say, hey, these are good jobs in your community. This money is staying in your community. So this is so much better for your community to fix up this old building than to build a new one. Because when you build a new one, 60% of your money is going to end up in China, you know. So there's this sort of that dimension of it. And then the other thing that I just want to mention, and I don't want to just have this kind of sound like a guilt trip, but this is a sort of a self-awakening that we need to go through, that when you actually look at what we build out of and you start to understand that all of it is part of these enormous global supply chains, and you start to, just like with embodied carbon, you start to go down those supply chains to see where these materials are coming from, how they're being manufactured, you know, who does what in which country as it comes to us. None of those supply chains are clean, not one of them. And, you know, I'm sure there's people that are going to hear that and say, no, we have a clean supply chain, but, you know, sort of prove it to us. A lot of the things that we consider to be green are materials that go back to places where there are like children harvesting them, you know? I mean, so us just simply getting aware of literally the resourcing of our materials in the building sector, this is an important thing for us to awaken to. And when we do, again, it's a force that's starting to, just like with food, like buy local, you know, go to the farmer's market. You know, it's like with the building supplies, it's the same thing. Do you really know where that lumber's coming from? Do you really know what you're building out of? And I'll just end it with one last thing. I was talking about adobe buildings. Right now, our global north bias is that there's one kind of, indigenous, green biological material source, and that's wood. Okay. The fact of the matter is earth is a locally resourced, you know, biological material as well. And we aren't paying enough attention to earthen construction in the global north. And I think there's tremendous potential with building out of earth.
This obviously reinforces your comment of the very, very prevalence, and you mentioned this in the book, the huge prevalence of the standard for enclosing everything in glass. You know, a high-performance glass building is an oxymoron, you actually say in the book. How do we get past that? And you know, who's leading the charge, and are they having any success in convincing people that you don't, in fact, need floor-to-ceiling windows in order to give you a view, and that we've survived for millennia without such advantages or disadvantages, as the case may be, in terms of environmental impact?
Well, it's another good topic that I'm glad that you brought up. Let me just give you one little kind of anecdotal example of the two icons of New York City, if you will. So the first is the icon of the 20th century, the Empire State Building, you know, a 100-story building that actually is now a LEED Gold building. It was renovated about a dozen years ago or so, maybe even 15 years ago, to LEED Gold standards. And then the icon of the 21st century in New York City, which is Freedom Tower, you know, 100-story all-glass tower on the former World Trade Center site. And it's also a LEED Gold building, I might add. You know, so the Empire State Building, built in the 30s, was going to, 80 years into its life, was going to receive this, you know, really kind of whole building upgrade and achieve the LEED Gold in the process. About a third of the facade was windows, which were essentially all the same size. They popped the windows out. They literally took them to an empty floor in the building, repaired them, upgraded them, put them back in the building. And then the other two-thirds of the facade was, okay, wait for it, washed. it just simply had to be cleaned. And actually, for us historic preservation people, we're like, oh, it didn't really have to be cleaned. You know, patina is what we call dirt that we like. You know, so at any rate, you know, either you liked the patina or you didn't like the patina, and they decided they didn't like it, so they washed the building. So the 21st century icon, New York City, the Freedom Tower, 50 years or 80 years from now, when they decide to, you know, have a whole building, you know, big major maintenance project done there, the facade is unrepairable. You know, it's a, quote, maintenance-free facade. And again, from a historic preservation world, we hear the word maintenance-free, and we know what that really means, that it's unrepairable. And when it fails, you have to replace it. And the reality is that, you know, our double glazed and triple glazed curtain wall is literally not recyclable. It's all assembled into these essentially unseparated integrated assemblies. So literally they're going to throw the facade out and put a new facade on it. So which one of those is a more sustainable approach to building? You know, and so I think that that's just in a nutshell. We really think that somehow or another, these glazing solutions are you know, one size fits all. It's going to make everything about the building work, and it just doesn't. The other thing I just mentioned is that I think actually the biggest force to say maybe an all glass building is not the greatest idea is actually Passive House, because Passive House is looking at facade performance very, very, very carefully, and just saying, you know, look, windows are the problem in a wall system. They always have been, they always will be. It's where we break the wall, and it creates all kinds of detailing issues and things like that. And you know, a non-operable curtain wall is attempt to reduce those things to, you know, as little as possible, because we don't actually have windows, we have a facade made out of glass, but it doesn't actually solve the problem. It just it makes it a different problem instead. So those, there are forces to you know, the embodied emissions that go with replacing a facade, et cetera, that are really saying that this is just not a good solution. Let's get back to ones that are better.
I'm in the skyscraper business, so your example of Empire State versus One World Trade Center is highly prescient and hits home, and it really, you know, underscores the difficulty that we face when we're trying to communicate, you know, best practices. And we're kind of looking at a set of practices that have been developed quite recently with the knowledge that it would be a major, perhaps an even greater effort to try to bring back the practices that preceded it that were actually more sustainable in the first place, even when we're talking about buildings at the scale of a skyscraper. I want to return to your point about facades and the window wall and the curtain wall, mentioning Passive House as a potential alternative, you know, which is very much focused on operational energy. There is a counter argument that one hears about Passive House, which is that you are increasing the amount of material that goes into your cladding in order to improve operational energy consumption. Therefore, you are adding to the embodied energy, and you know that may not always be a good trade-off. And I would throw that into the mix to ask your opinion about that assertion, but also the assertion, basically the same assertion when it comes to something like a double skin facade, which were very trendy a few years ago, especially in my business, the skyscraper business.
So you sort of, you know, opened the door to a very big and an important conversation in this. And let me just start the response by saying, if we were talking about designing jet aircraft or something, we would have very little history to draw on. You know, there weren't even airplanes much more than 100 years ago. So, you know, everything that we would be talking about would be very current, very much informed by our kind of science orientation and using computers to simulate things like that. Okay. But we're not. We're talking about buildings. And we actually have an encyclopedia that has been built for 6,000 years about how to build buildings in cities. And, you know, we think that we're in such a uniquely modern era, you know, and that, you know, anybody that didn't live in a fully air-conditioned building had to suffer through their lives. But it's such a biased opinion. You know, like, what did Cleopatra and Aristotle and Joan of Arc and Leonardo da Vinci and Benjamin Franklin have in common? They never lived in an air-conditioned building. I mean, life didn't just exist. Civilization didn't just exist. It thrived. You know, Shakespeare wrote all his plays, you know, whatever, just whatever example resonates with you. You know, our world, you know, built all the cathedrals, wrote all the great books, you know, without being part of the fossil fuel era that we're now part of, okay? And all of the sort of things that have come with industrialization and come with, you know, infinite energy expenditure. So how much of that encyclopedia are we looking at when we're starting to think about what the solutions to the future might look like? And the answer is, we're looking at, you know, the end of the last chapter, the last three pages, and that's it. And that's the only part of the encyclopedia that we're even looking at. So we're just robbing ourselves of a rich tradition to learn from. And that's just, I think the technical term for that is stupid. You know, I mean, we're just, you know, ignoring a lot of things that could really be helpful. And then, so what about it? And we've talked a little bit about materiality. And, you know, the old school solution to passive house was what was called thermal mass. And, you know, you built buildings out of earth or stone, and, you know, various forms of earth, whether it was, you know, soil-related earth, or whether it was, you know, lithosphere, you know, resourced earth. And it had a lot of mass to it. And, you know, it literally takes the sine curve of what happens to temperature over the day, or the sine curve of what happens to temperature over the seasons, and it levels it out a lot, very significantly. You know, so that was the sort of passive house solution for literally thousands of years. And it's like, oh yeah, but, you know, they didn't do woofy modeling. Yeah, they didn't do woofy modeling, but they created buildings that really worked. You know, I mean, Vitruvius talks about this. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. This has been around for a long time. The other thing that they did was they understood that they had to build to their climates, and that the building form, every building decision that was made with the idea that they were having to cope with a climate in mind, you know. And so building form was really, you know, informed to be climate responsive. And there's good examples of that. There's bad examples of that. You know, people started building buildings that looked like they, you know, somebody that Susan Roff, who is somebody whose work, if you don't know, look up Susan Roff. You know, she talks about the worst buildings that were ever built was when the British architects went to Rome and saw the Roman buildings and thought that that's what they needed to build in London. And they completely abandoned their cold London, you know, architecture for glorious sunny Italy architecture. And it never worked, you know, it never made a good building in Britain. But the other thing that's sort of part of that is operability. And it's really a really important part of what we've forgotten. So we've forgotten about the materiality of our buildings, we've forgotten about the form of our buildings, and we've forgotten about the operability of our buildings, and literally making it so that open a window, close a window, actually go to the warm side of the house or the cool side of the house, go to the outside, to the porch, you know, I mean, just that notion that you can literally move about within your environment to adapt to your environment, because that's what we do naturally. That we are, as creatures, we are very adaptable creatures. We actually, our metabolisms adjust to our environment. That's part of our health, is to do that. We're hardwired to do that. And buildings that try to keep a 70 degrees, 50% humidity, 365 days a year are actually not healthy for us.
I want to jump in, Carl, looking forward, and not just, of course, what we can learn from past preservation, but I'm curious your thoughts on the role of potential technology in this, because, you know, we live in a time where basically every business model these days is to collect as much data as possible and then ask questions about it in the future. And architecture is a profession where architects do not collect any data on the performance of their buildings, because, of course, that's the client work there. And I'm curious your thoughts on this, about what potential there is from basically, like, applying the similar set of statistical rigor that they do in so many other fields, which is to learn about building performance, build models, and be able to basically sort of deploy that at scale. It strikes me as something that a lot of tech startups are doing, companies like Passive Logic and others that are trying to create smart buildings and build this out. But what can we learn from the tech side of the ledger here in terms of basically using this to measure and create baselines of new performance?
Yep. So it's one of the things that sort of defines the fascinating part of our time right now. I mean, literally bringing these two things together. We started out for the first couple hundred years of having technology at our beck and call, but all we had to do was say it's more technical, and we were like, yes, that's great. It's more technical. Fantastic. Well, was it really helping? Was it really doing anything for us? We hardly even answered that, tried to ask that question, let alone answer it. And it was like, hey, it's just better. It's more technology. You know, I'll just give you the electric cars as a great example. You know, okay, we have this whole new technology. Oh, it's electric cars. Oh, that's so great. From a global warming perspective, well, we're trading scope one emissions for scope two emissions. They don't go away. And then in terms of actually scope three, the embodied emissions from building a car, we're still building 3,000-pound suits of armor for people to run around in, you know. Do we need a 3,000-pound suit of armor to get from point A to point B? And our cities being choked with electric vehicles are no better than our cities being choked with gas guzzlers. They're not better communities, you know. They might have cleaner air, even though the power plants are polluting our air. You know, but, you know, so let's actually talk about holistically what are the solutions that are really better solutions. But I'll just give you my favorite example of the mini split, you know, the little mini split heat pump, you know. So there's a lot of, on a big kind of technology scale, you know, heat pump technology is an incredibly important part, just like LED lighting. That just like for us to sort of have our cake and eat it too. We get to have all the lighting we want to have, and we get to do it without this incredible energy burden that lighting had since it was born, you know, when Thomas Edison came up with the light bulb. So that's great. And now we have heat pumps, and it's kind of the same thing with air conditioning and with heating. Now we have a technology that's inherently so much more energy efficient that it's really great. But what we miss in that is actually the glory of the mini split, you know. So the mini split puts a little unit in every room that you need to have your heating or cooling in. And what that means is that, you know, I'm in my little 1200 square foot house here, you know, it has seven rooms. If I had a central air conditioner in here, I would flip the switch on and I would be cooling all seven rooms, or I would flip the switch and I'd be heating all seven rooms. But with the mini split, I can be doing exactly what I'm doing right now. I'm sitting in a house that's on a 90 degree day. The rest of the house has the windows open. Nobody's in there. It doesn't need to be cooled. I'm in my little cubicle here in the corner. I've got my mini split on. I'm cooling me for what I need for the hour that I need it. And that's a kind of an operability mindset that goes back to it's summer in the South and you open the windows and you throw the windows open on the cupola and you create an operational mode that is designed for the situation that you're faced with. And when do you need to do that? Your body tells you you're hot. not the Fitbit on your wrist, not the thermostat on the wall. Your body says, hey, I'm hot. You go and you do something about it. So the mini split is great to me because not only is it an energy efficient technology, but the scaling of it actually gets back to sort of an operationalized notion that it's this practical thing that people can actually utilize the way that they would open a window in the past. And I'll just end this by saying, I feel like with our automating technology, our automation should never be allowed to turn anything on. It should only turn things off, you know, and that we, if you need something on, press the button, turn it on, you know, don't have your smart building say, this is what I need to be doing to make your environment good for you. You know, when you go, you know, athletic trainers, the first thing they try to teach their athletes is you need to connect to your body. Your body needs to be telling you what I need to do to train you. This is not me telling you. This is your body telling me how I need to train you. And that's kind of where our mindset ought to be about comfort, you know, with our adapted comfort. You know, put people back at the center of feeling their bodies, really being attuned to their biology, and then interceding with their environment to have the comfort that they're seeking. And that's what we did for 6,000 years until we decided that we'd let the thermostat do the thinking for us. And we're smarter than a thermostat.
Carl, that's amazing insight. I'm going to go right out and find a company that does split switches to invest in, because I think your words will be prophetic. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Unfrozen today. It has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a real pleasure being with you again. Thanks for the invitation. You guys are doing great work. Keep it up.